Chapter 14. Con Men. Would you believe that a car could be run on water instead of gasoline? Before you answer no, consider the incredible case of the inventor Louis Ehrlich. In the year 1916, the world was gripped by an oil crisis. One April morning, New York's reporters were invited to call on a house in Farmingdale, Long Island, to witness a demonstration which, they were assured, would be spectacular. The few reporters who turned up found a big, grey-haired man with an impressive face and a foreign accent, who introduced himself as Louis Ehrlich, and explained that he had invented a cheap substitute for gasoline. The reporters yawned and looked bored. Ehrlich led them to a small European car, pointed out that the gas tank was empty, and asked the reporters to examine it closely to see that there was no supplementary fuel tank. They weren't experts, but it certainly didn't look as if Ehrlich was deceiving them. Ehrlich then asked a reporter to fill a bucket at a tap. When the man returned with the water, the inventor produced a bottle full of green liquid. He told the man to empty it into the bucket, warning him that the stuff was deadly poison. The reporter poured the bucket into the gas tank, and Ehrlich asked the driver to try the engine. After a few splutters, it started, and a smell of almonds pervaded the air. Ehrlich offered each of the reporters a ride around Farmingdale. If there was a concealed gas tank, which is the obvious hypothesis, then it must have been large, for the car trips went on for at least an hour. The next day, the story made the front pages, and Ehrlich was besieged with letters, phone calls, and reporters. He declined to see them. A Harvard professor declared sourly that no possible combination of chemicals could turn water into a combustible fuel, but Ehrlich declined to comment. His next visitor was Henry Ford himself. Ford examined the car carefully, and, since he was one of the world's leading experts, he was pretty thorough. He watched Ehrlich mix his green liquid with the water, and then went for a ride in the car. Ehrlich admitted that the smell was cyanide, but he said it had been put in to conceal another smell. His process was absurdly simple, he said, and until his lawyer had devised a way to patent it, he wasn't dropping any hints. Ford was so impressed that even when the Tribune printed a story revealing that Ehrlich had been a fake company promoter, Ford ignored it. The evidence of his own eyes assured him that the car had run on water, and he gave Ehrlich a cheque for $10,000 on account. When this news was leaked to the papers by Ehrlich, Hiram P. Maxim, son of the inventor of the Maxim gun, offered Ehrlich $1 million and offered to build him a laboratory for further research. In fact, Ehrlich received only $100,000. He was to receive the rest when he handed over the formula, which, Maxim agreed, should not be until he had patented his discovery. Ford was infuriated, but since Ehrlich had returned his cheque, there was nothing much he could do. Then America came into the First World War, and Maxim was so busy making munitions that he agreed to call off the whole thing. He had more than recovered his investment in the upward turn taken by his company's shares when his deal with Ehrlich was announced. The man who decided to take over from Maxim was a rich banker named Joachim. He also gave Ehrlich $100,000, accepting a sealed envelope which was supposed to contain the formula. Joachim told President Wilson that he intended to present the secret of a penny a gallon fuel to the American people, and Wilson was delighted. But Ehrlich launched delaying tactics, and Joachim hired the Pinkerton Detective Agency to investigate him. He was flabbergasted to discover that Ehrlich had been seen consorting with von Papen, the German military attaché, before the outbreak of war, and that the inventor was suspected of being a German spy. Then Joachim opened the envelope that was supposed to contain the formula, and found only a few Liberty bonds. But there was no way to get Ehrlich into a court of law. Joachim had broken his own undertaking by opening the envelope. Talk about trying Ehrlich for treason dragged on until Joachim died, and Ehrlich was once again in the clear. At the age of 75, Ehrlich was still a man of restless imagination. In 1920, he announced that his continued experiments in the manufacture of gasoline had led him to conclude that the easiest and cheapest way was to distill it from peat. Such was the magic of his name that investors again rushed to thrust cheques into his hand, and he may have received as much as $250,000. But the Nassau County District Attorney decided it was time that someone brought Ehrlich's career to an end. The DA examined Ehrlich's bank accounts and found that he had a cheque for $2,000, handed over by an investor, and promptly endorsed to pay a bookmaker. That was fraud, since he was a limited company and all money was supposed to benefit other investors. At the age of 77, Enrich received 7 years in jail for grand larceny. Paroled after a few years, he died at the age of 79 without revealing to anyone the secret of his formula for cheap gasoline. How did he do it? The answer may lie in a formula discovered by Thomas Edison. He found that a mixture of acetone and liquid acetylene will drive a car if mixed with water. If cyanide is added, it hides the very distinctive nail varnish smell of acetone. The mixture costs more to make than gasoline, and it also had the disadvantage of corroding the engine after a while. But this is probably the answer to the enigma. Undoubtedly, the most remarkable con man of them all was a Scotsman, John Law. Born in Edinburgh in 1671, Law had no need to work. His father, a successful goldsmith and moneylender, left him two estates. But Law was immensely ambitious. Besides, he was driven by another itch that characterises many of the great conmen, the passion for beautiful women. At 23, he went to London, where his success in love became as legendary as his success at cards. He packed more experience into the next 5 years than most men manage in a lifetime. Then his luck turned. He killed a man in a duel. He was tried and fled to the continent. There he continued to gamble and seduce, but he also became a fascinated student of high finance. It seemed to him that the secret of wealth was a perfectly simple one. All businesses run on credit, and the more money they make, the more they borrow in order to expand. But in those days, money was made of gold or silver, and there was a limited amount of it to go around. The answer, said Law, was to print paper money instead, which could be instantly redeemed for gold merely by walking into a bank. But so long as the customers trusted their paper money, why should they demand gold instead? And in that case, the government could issue any amount of paper money and use it to increase trade. So long as there was no sudden panic, it was a foolproof way of increasing credit and prosperity. Law returned to Scotland, which at the time had its own government, so that he was safe from arrest, and he tried hard to persuade his fellow countrymen of the value of a national bank that would issue paper money. He was ignored, and when Scotland discussed union with England, he decided it was time to return to the continent. In 1708 he went to Paris and found it was the most exciting capital in Europe. Everyone gambled. Soon Law was known in the most exclusive drawing rooms in Paris, and the size of his stakes made him famous. He met the Duc d'Orléans and convinced him of his financial genius. For a while it looked as though he would get his opportunity to print paper money. Then the police began investigating him. D'Argenson, lieutenant of the Paris police, had received hundreds of complaints from losers who doubted Law's honesty. Law was driven out of France. In 1715, Louis XIV died. Law could hardly believe his luck when he heard that his old friend, the Duc d'Orléans, had been appointed regent of the young king and was virtually dictator of France. He hurried back to Paris, and this time the Duke allowed him to put his schemes into effect. To begin with, he gave Law permission to open a private bank and to print his own money. Law had built up a fortune of £80,000, so he had the gold to back his notes. He started out cautiously, aiming to create confidence. He lost money, but people came to feel that his notes were as safe as gold. By 1718, Law's bank was making so much money that the Duke transformed it into a royal bank. Law could print as much money as he liked. Now, obviously, this was a very dangerous game. It's true that money makes money, but if there's a slump or a sudden panic, a bank must have enough money to change all its notes into gold, or collapse. In theory, Law had all the money he needed. It was now time to use it to make more money, real money. The answer lay across the Atlantic in Louisiana, which belonged to the French. Louisiana consisted of thousands of square miles of swamps and uncultivated land. Law set himself to persuade the French people that it was full of gold, silk and valuable minerals, and that all they had to do to double their money was to invest it in Louisiana bonds. The money flowed in. Law cornered the Canadian fur market and made huge profits. But he was now aware of the dangers of this incredible game of confidence. As the money poured in, share prices rose. Speculators could make fortunes overnight. Everything went faster and faster, and Law had to keep running faster than anybody else, always making sure that he had the gold to meet all demands. If Louisiana was to make money, he had to persuade emigrants to go there. Law hired men to go throughout France, telling stories of the wealth of Louisiana. From the government, he purchased the right to collect taxes, and he made a vast fortune that way. He bought trading companies in the Far East. He cornered Virginia tobacco. The money kept flooding in. His office in the narrow Rue Quincampoix was besieged by crowds day and night. Any shares he deigned to sell could be resold within minutes for twice their price. Moneylenders nearby lent money at 1% per hour, and their customers still made a fortune. Soon there wasn't enough gold to go around. The Duke d'Orléans had to be persuaded to pass laws forbidding goldsmiths to make gold articles weighing more than a few ounces. Confidence slumped, and the rush came. At first, the bank would only cash 100 livres note per person. Soon this was reduced to 10 livres. And in December 1720, 2 years after he'd become the head of the Compagnie de l'Occident, Law decided it would be safer to flee the country. For the next few years, he lived quietly in London. His old skill as a gambler had not deserted him. When he had only £1,000 left, he staked it all on a bet that he could throw six double sixes one after the other. He won. But his luck turned, perhaps due to the curses of thousands of Frenchmen whom he'd ruined. He remained on friendly terms with the Duke d'Orléans to the end. The Duke had remedied the bankruptcy by the simple expedient of burning every paper connected with the Royal Bank. But when Law finally died in Venice in 1729, he was again a pauper. In the year of the collapse of Law's Compagnie de l'Occident, England was having its own grave financial crisis, the bursting of the South Sea bubble. The full details of the dealings of the South Sea Company are even more complex than those of Law's Royal Bank, but the parallels are otherwise very close. Law needed the permission of the regent to start his company. The directors of the South Sea Company got their permission for their vast dealings by offering to take on the English national debt, that is, the money that the government owes investors in government stocks. Their equivalent of Louisiana was Peru and the South Seas. Between 1711 and 1720, millions of pounds changed hands and fortunes were made. All kinds of other schemes swept to success on the tail of the South Sea Comet, a scheme for making a wheel of perpetual motion, a scheme for making a soft metal out of mercury. One speculator even launched a scheme for great advantage, but nobody to know what it is, and made £2,000 in one morning. The South Sea directors had to take legal action against these other companies, and in doing so they started the panic that led to the crash. In this case, some investors got back at least some of their money, for the government seized part of the assets of the directors of the company. The classic con case of modern times is undoubtedly that of Count Victor Lustig's sale of the Eiffel Tower, not once, but twice. Like John Law, Lustig came from a respectable middle-class family, and he too loved gambling and women. Sometime before the First World War, he left his home in Czechoslovakia and moved to Paris. Lustig was only one of 24 aliases that he used at different times. He learned the techniques of confidence trickery from the gambler Nicky Arnstein. Lustig was in Paris when he saw a newspaper item reporting repairs to the Eiffel Tower would cost thousands of francs. Some days later, several rich financiers received letters from a government department inviting them to a secret conference at the Hotel Crillon. The director deputy general who received them was actually Victor Lustig. He began by assuring them that his business was classified as top secret, hence the hotel suite instead of his office. The government had decided, he told them, that the Eiffel Tower was too expensive to maintain. It was to be sold for scrap metal. They gaped. "Would you gentlemen care to submit your bids to me?" He'd already noted the man who was the obvious mark, André Poisson, a man who clearly felt socially inferior to the others. A few days later, Lustig rang him and told him that his bid was the highest, several million francs, and that if he would bring a certified cheque to the hotel, the deal could be concluded. Poisson was not entirely happy, until Lustig apologetically asked for a bribe to ensure that negotiations would go smoothly. That convinced Poisson that this was indeed a genuine government official. He handed over the cash. And later, when it became clear that he'd been swindled, he was too ashamed to go to the police and make himself the laughingstock of France. The result was that Lustig was able to repeat the same trick a few years later. The second part of Lustig's life was an anticlimax, an observation that applies to most confidence tricksters. In America in the early 1930s, he turned to the distribution of counterfeit money. The FBI finally caught up with him, and he was sentenced to 20 years in jail, dying in Alcatraz in 1947. The federal agent mainly responsible for his capture, James P. Johnson, wrote the classic book on his career under the title The Man Who Sold the Eiffel Tower. It's a saddening book, for it underlines the strange romanticism that leads brilliant and imaginative men to become confident swindlers.